Angus Young, how you doing?
Good, Becca.
The Offspring.
How's it going, Becca?
Dave Grohl, how you going, mate?
Good, man.
Pete, it's been a long time coming.
Oh, Becca, hasn't it indeed?
We go inside the dressing room, speak to the biggest names in music.
Keith Richards, the Rolling Stones.
And crack open their esky.
This is exactly how I imagined you, by the way, sitting opposite me with a vodka and orange.
You're a discerning chap.
This is The Rider.
Hey, it's Becca. Welcome back to The Rider. Last week was Chit Chat from Machine Gun Fellatio and, of course, on Max TV. And one of the great guests, I mean, some great stories coming out of Sydney's thriving music scene back in the 90s. You can go back and catch up on that on all platforms. Now, this week on the podcast, it is Ben Gillies.
Like, we were kids. Like, so the fact that we were, like, pulling off those shows and doing what we were doing, like, it even kind of blows my mind now that we were getting away with it. Maybe we were just faking it until we made it. I don't know how we did it, but somehow we did. We were really lucky with the people that we had around us.
They were seriously just kids. It's incredible the music that they were putting out at the age of 15. From early Silverchair to... And then he came out with his first solo music under the name Bento. Now, this was 10 years ago when Bento came out. And now some new music from Ben Gillies. On the stereo. Ben Gillies from Silverchair, and now with some incredible solo music, which is out now. You can stream it on Spotify right now, and here he is.
Mr. Beckhouse.
There he is. How are ya?
I'm good, mate. How are you?
Mate, I'm good. Dude, I miss you. We had so many fun times, and I actually realised it was 10 years ago when Bento came out.
Holy shit, dude. Isn't that crazy?
It is crazy.
Hey, you know what? I actually just, so I'm starting Twitch.
Yeah.
And I've been chatting a lot with Nathan Cavalieri.
Oh, great.
Yeah, and he's like, he's kind of been like my guide through the whole thing. Yeah, he's just been walking me through it and how to hook everything up and how to engage. And actually, he even started the whole journey. He called me up and he's like, "Ben, I reckon this would be really good for you." I was like, oh, yeah, I'll have a look at it. And fuck, it's a rabbit hole, I'll tell you that much.
It is. And, you know, it's obviously also been taken over with people talking about, was it EFTs and all that stuff and you know, crypto. And, you know, it's all over the shop. But, of course, gamers as well and now musicians. By the way, nice setup behind you there. Are you in a party house with the drums?
No, it's my home studio.
Nice.
Yeah, it's a little vibe. It's good. It's pretty new, but it's getting there. You can't really. So I've got a little piano there. You know, some vintage keys. It's not big, but it's only me. It doesn't need to be very large. You know, for a single person.
Tell you what, that Real Housewives of Melbourne money's coming through. I mean, when you look at that.
Yeah, it's a good vibe, man. You know what? I should have built as home studio 10 years ago, because you know, you spend so much money on studios that eventually you're kind of like, oh, I could have just done it all at home.
Oh, well, and that's what's happened now, where you don't need the big desk, the multi-million dollar studio or anything like that. And I've seen people go in and use those great studios and the great Neve desks, but they ended up don't even using it. They bypass and end up just sort of plugging in a laptop and doing all the work on that.
You know what, for drums, actually, the fact that you mentioned Neve desks, the compression on Neve desks make drums sound absolutely beautiful.
Yeah.
I don't know how it does that, but I know it does it. But yeah, look, you know, technology is so convenient and so good. Like, I think when Pro Tools... Well, that's what I use. I mean, there's like Ableton and Logic. There's different programs you can use. But, you know, I think for a time there, like, you know, if you went straight into the box and recorded straight into the box, like it almost sounded digital. But the technology is so good now that if people claim that they can tell, like, they probably can't. Like, you don't really need a big, huge desk. You don't need all the gear anymore. Like, you know, but you just need some key pieces, like a really nice preamp and a compressor for your vocals or, yeah. I mean, it sounds like I know what I'm talking about. I actually really don't.
It's amazing how many musos actually aren't trained with how to read music.
Yeah, there's particular instruments where you can kind of fake it as long as you know some of the shapes. It's literally just like different shapes, like of a chord or different, you know, that's the main thing. And then once you know the notes within that shape of the chord, you can then pick those notes out and use them for, you know, solos or a melody or whatever. So, yeah, you know, and I always find that a lot of musos actually write the best music on the instrument that they're least familiar with because they're not trained and they're not like, you know, if you're playing the dominant, you know, chord of the key, then, you know, you have to go to the tonic or whatever it is, you know. If you're unrestricted by those rules, you just play what feels good and what sounds good to your ear. And sometimes that's a lot of the time, or maybe most of the time, that's the best way to do it, rather than kind of going, you know, I have to go to this chord or I have to play this note because that's what the rules are.
Well, and Dave Grohl talked about the guitar and he didn't know, you know, the different chords or whatever. He talked about how it's like drumming, you know, certain strings were like the snare and certain strings were like the cymbals, and that's how he learned to play the guitar.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I can totally relate. I think I've seen that Dave Grohl thing as well, and I think he's probably had that chat a few times.
I think he has, yeah,
But I totally relate to it. Like, I find I do that on piano. Like, I always kind of like, you know, something's always playing the snare, like dun 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 dun. You know, something's always hitting that snare.
Yeah, yeah.
Finding the balance between some of that musical knowledge and, you know, also letting it all go and just going from what feels good, because ultimately that's, you just want it to feel good.
Yeah, of course you do. And by the way, the last song on the stereo, That was really brilliant, and I know you had a lot of work going to that. Where'd you record that one?
I actually did that in Brisbane.
Right.
So that was a little idea that I had kind of laying around for a little while, and then I co-wrote it with Scott Applin.
Yep. Yep.
Who's a pretty well-known muso in Australia. And then I went to record it with Constantine. I hope I'm saying that right.
I know, I had to sort of write it down and rehearse it. Yeah, so, and you've worked with him before.
No, that was the first track I've ever done with Con.
Really?
I've
right.
done a, yeah. And then I worked on another one with him called Dangerous Distractions.
Yeah.
And then I've done a bunch of work with him now, and I really like Con. He's efficient. When you get in the studio with him, he just gets it done. I love it. It's really it's good fun.
What's good, because you want someone who's going to obviously take control, and I know some bands when there's two or three creators and a producer who's just trying to piece it all together, it could drag on for weeks, you know, months. And you just want to get in and get out, don't you, when you want to record a song.
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, it's ready when it's ready.
Yeah,
I mean, I do think there is a point where if you're working on something that it can get a bit too overindulgent. But I think, I mean, with Con, with that track, that was 2 days. So we went, and the writing wasn't even fully finished. Like the middle eight for that song wasn't, like, I hadn't done that yet. So I went in there with like a really strong verse and chorus. You know, so wrote the middle eight while I was there, and then we recorded it and put it all together. I actually, some of the lyrics weren't even finished. So yeah, it just depends. You know, I think if you're willing to just to let the song have its own kind of life, and if it takes 6 months to finish and record a song, that's fine. If it takes a week or a day or whatever, you know, it is what it is. As long as you're aware that, you know, you're not kind of overcooking it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it just felt like a great easygoing summer hit, you know, and I really hope it gets some traction, not just here, but over the States during their summer, because it just jumped out. I hope it catches on over there. Well, first of all, I got to say, what's it like being a dad? I haven't seen you since you've had twins. Like, this is crazy.
Do you have kids?
No, not yet. So for both of us, it's a big deal.
It is a big deal, man. It's awesome. It's everything that everyone says it is. Actually, what parents, when they're talking to people that aren't parents, it's more like they're just warnings. Yeah, so you have a lot of penny drop moments, but, you know, most of all, like, you just love your kids more than you could ever imagine. You can't explain it until it happens. And when you're holding your own child, you're like, I will do anything on this planet to make sure that you're safe and protected. And, yeah, and, you know, when you wake up in the morning, you go and pick them up and they've got a big smile and you give them a cuddle and it's like, holy fuck, this is awesome.
And I can imagine this is something you never prepared for. And I've heard so many dads say the same thing to me and say, look, you know, when it's your turn, that's how it's going to be. You're never really ready for it. But when you do and when it happens, it changes you forever. And I think you've summed it up so well. And look, I look forward to it one day. I'm just, you know, haven't got to that point yet.
I get it, man. And you know what? I think I was the same. Like, in hindsight, I could have done it. Like, I'm 42. And they were born, I was 42. No, I was 41. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I had my birthday just afterwards. But, you know, I reckon around that mid-30s is a really good point, you know, for me. Well, it's probably different for everyone. But for me, I probably could have started around then. But, you know, it doesn't matter. That isn't how it panned out. But, yeah, man, you also realize when you have children that it's not as scary as you think. Like, I think you're just a bit worried, right? Like, am I going to be a good parent? Am I going to, like, how much is it going to change my life? Like, particularly if you like your lifestyle. Like, I love, pre-kids, I love my lifestyle. I could do whatever I want, whatever I want, you know. You could, if you're watching a cool series that you're really enjoying and it was midnight and you wanted to watch another episode, you could easily do that. I cannot do that anymore. Not for a little while anyway. But the thing is, all that stuff, you don't care. You really don't care. And also the shift is instant. There's no easing into it. There's no, like, you know, Jackie was pregnant and we went to the hospital and we pretty much had a pretty similar lifestyle. And then once those kids were born, man, it's like, doof, like completely different overnight. There is no, yeah, it was, it's a big change and it's overnight. But you know what? Yeah, you don't give a shit.
No,
it's awesome.
No, are you drinking more now than you were back then before baby or?
although I've had a couple of bumps in the road, I've been a non-drinker for about 7 or 8 years.
Right. That's good.
Yeah, I did. Believe me, before that, I probably drank enough for a few lifetimes.
You'd text me sometimes and you'd be downstairs at the Civic and you go, hey, I'm downstairs. And you'd be like 3 beers already in and it'd be the middle of the day for me and I'd be like, I got to go back to work.
Yeah, see, that's why.
Yeah.
Middle of the day, you shouldn't be 3 beers in unless it's a, you know, Sunday afternoon.
It must be hard though because musicians are so used to waiting around. And I know it's sort of like where when you're in a band and you're traveling, you spend all the time waiting and it must be so hard to not just start drinking at 11 o'clock because you're not on stage till 7 o'clock at night or later even, you know. That's probably the hardest part, boredom.
Yeah. I look in for the – with Silverchair, like for me, like particularly when we were younger, like it wasn't really part of the makeup of how we traveled and how we operated. I mean, there was definitely drinking around, and as we got older, like there was a little bit more. But yeah, it was never really part of our kind of ethos on the road, I don't think. It was more so on probably on our last record is where, you know, we started like drinking before stage. And it was hard for me because I enjoyed having a drink, but, you know, I had to – I mean, actually all of us had to be really sharp to play, to be honest. But to play the drums, I think you just you can't be too intoxicated because you just lose that coordination. So I, you know, I always tried not to have too much before we played, maybe like two maximum. But then, you know, occasionally we'd have like toward the end of a show, you'd be like having swigs from like vodka bottles, and you know, then but you do fall victim to that thing where you go, oh, this is awesome. But the truth is, like, no, you if you're a bit drunk, you're probably not playing that well.
Yeah, well, some are better at it than others. Like some are just well-conditioned drinkers and going on stage, and but they always tend to slip up at some point. There's always a tipping point. Where was your first drink, by the way? Because Silverchair, you know, I forget how young you guys were. Like you were 15.
I think my first drink was like 14 before the band kind of took off.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe that was just being in the 90s in Newcastle, kind of part of the thing here, you know.
I was looking back and reminiscing and all that. What was the moment where you realised, oh, hang on, this might actually be a career? Was it moments like Big Day Out, or was it the Royal Easter Show? Everyone described that as a big moment.
In terms of like, I can do this as a career, I don't know. Like we were in such a whirlwind when the band first took off. Like I think we were just riding the wave. Like we were lucky enough to have people around us that had a longer vision for the band, you know, and they didn't, they made sure that we weren't milked for, you know, just for the novelty factor. And then, you know, probably burn out by the time you're 18. There was always longevity in mind. Yeah, so I was never thinking of like, this could be a career. It just kind of became that. But I do remember a moment when I think Tomorrow had been number one or Frog Stomp. Tomorrow or Frog Stomp had been number one for like 4 or 5 weeks straight. And I was always, I guess I've always been a music fan. So I kept an eye on even then I'd keep an eye on, because I remember going to record stores and they'd have the ARIA chart printed out.
That yes.
I'd always keep an eye on the ARIA chart and, you know, see if there was any new artists or, you know, any new bands to check out. So the fact that we were number one for like so many consecutive weeks, that was a moment for me to be like, yeah, this is really cool.
It's insane how big it was, and this is when music really paid as well. I mean, actually, that's the question. Did it pay well early on, or did it take a little while to get those checks rolling in?
Oh, you know, we did pretty well out of the band. You know, yeah. I think for me personally, like that wasn't kind of my motivation. My motivation was that we were blessed enough to be able to do something that we loved and we were passionate about. So, you know, look, the financial benefits, you know, they're great. Like I'm not going to complain, but you know, I think one of the reasons we were so successful is because we were so passionate about what we were doing.
So ridiculously gifted for that age.
Even like the performances, like I just, I look at 14 year olds now and just, and like they're kids basically.
Yeah.
You know, we were kids. Like, so the fact that we were like pulling off those shows and doing what we were doing, like it even kind of blows my mind now that we were getting away with it. Maybe we were just faking it until we made it. I don't think we were faking it. You know, it felt like we were, I don't know how we did it, but somehow we did. We were really lucky with the people that we had around us, and, you know, and my parents were always really supportive of what I was doing, so.
And you would have been so grounded coming back to Newcastle, and there would have been times when it would be a bit crazy with the kids at school and jealousy and bullying even and whatever, but still you come back to Newcastle and things haven't changed.
Yeah, and, you know, I think we did our best to stay in school, which in hindsight was quite strange, but, you know, you were living this really odd kind of manic life of going on tour and being in studios and rehearsing and tour buses. And then you'd get home and, you know, you'd go to school with your schoolmates and you just like, you'd just be thinking to yourself, like 2 weeks ago, I was either in a studio like recording or I was on the stage, you know, on the other side of the world, and now I'm back like walking with my school bag with my books going to this class. Like it was really odd, but I guess in a way it also, for me anyway, it helped me kind of just have a reality check. It would be really easy to get carried away with that kind of success that kind of quickly and just thinking that you're a golden god and thinking that you're you know, that you're some magical unicorn sent to Earth to save the human race.
Yeah. Oh, you would have been brought back down to Earth pretty quickly.
And you're right, in Newcastle and like our friends and like, you know, my closest friends are still my closest friends now from those days. And they're so important, you know, those people in my life are really important to me because, well, they're my friends for me. You know, it's not because of, you know, what the band did. They're just my mates. You know, and I guess they just wouldn't put up with it, you know, and that's what you need, you know. You need those people. For me, it's important to have those people in your life. Even if the band wasn't successful, you know, I think everyone needs those people in your life that just keep you honest, you know, call you on your shit.
Yeah, they go, oh, come on, dickhead, settle down, you know.
No one's perfect either, you know. Yeah. We all make mistakes, so, but... Yeah, I guess if you make a mistake and your friends stick around and they can call you on your shit, like they're your true friends, you know, and they're the ones that you that's been an important part of my journey with the band is having those people in my life that are genuine.
You don't have many of those normally, so you hang on to them pretty tight. I got to ask you, Bento. So yeah. that was 10 years ago. It's taken you a long time to come out as Ben Gillies. Is that because you were just shit scared?
Oh, totally. That was just me being, you know, trying to kind of, totally. Like it's just a confidence thing, you know, like I stopped writing music in Silverchair after the third record. I think I had one or two tracks on the third record. And then Dan basically took over from there and did all the writing for the last two records. I did all my drum parts, but you know, I guess from the right, like the, you know, writing the other musical parts. Yeah. I just lost a lot of confidence. I don't know. I just had to find my confidence again, you know? And I think Bento for me was like a project that was a bit of a stepping stone to kind of get back to a place where I was really happy with it. Like I'm really happy with the stuff that I did for that project. But I feel like I wasn't quite ready just to say, hey, this is me, this is my music. So that's why it took, you know, and some, you know, those processes can take a couple of years, they can take 10 years, but I guess it doesn't matter how long they take as long as they need.
You must have felt empty though before you were able to put out that first project, the end of Silverchair, because it was a matter of years before you started working on other stuff.
Yeah, I was always working on music. I'm always, even now, I'm always working on stuff. And I'm not the most prolific songwriter, like, but I have a lot. I do have a lot of musical ideas and I'm always pumping them out. But I guess there's a certain level that I want the music to be like, you know, there's a lot of fat that I kind of just get rid of to find the stuff that I really like and that I want to release. But you know, it's just, I don't know, man, music's just, it's just a way of kind of dealing with stuff, you know? And, yeah. And I think when you're a muso and when you write music, it's just this urge inside of you. Like you get I might go like weeks without doing anything and then something will just trigger me and I'll hear a melody or in my head and I'll just be like, it'll just keep going around and around and around. I'm just like, I have to purge this thing because otherwise it's going to drive me crazy. So, and it feels good to get it out, you know.
Well, it's a bit like when you get a song stuck in your head. So I'm sure it's the same thing, except your song hasn't been written yet.
Totally. It's just a melody, or it's just just an idea. Like, you know, it's, you know, we all get them. Like if you get an idea that just rolls around your head, like you need to get it. Like, you know, some people write, some people paint, some people make music, some people, I don't know, whatever it is, whatever your vice is to get it out. You just got to do it.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you'll end up in a loony bin.
Is the industry a bit easier now to put music out because it's almost instantaneous? I mean, there's always a process, but there's really nothing stopping you from doing a song tonight and putting it out somewhere.
Yeah, 100%. Look, I think the path to releasing something is a hell of a lot easier. But I almost feel like the kind of success that Silverchair had, like to kind of reach that success, like I reckon it's almost harder. You know, there's so much music and there's so much noise from like social media and, you know, all the screens are computers and phones and like you just constantly bombarded from stuff. Like, I think it's probably even harder to stand out from all of that. I mean, even for me, like to discover music, you know, I mean, I think we all fall into that trap of like that, you know, whatever the music was that you're listening to when you're in your teens, like you tend to gravitate back to whatever that was. But, you know, I really enjoy discovering new artists or new bands or whatever. And, you know, even doing that now, like it's not the same as talking to your mates and, you know, you go and buy a CD and like, you know, the musical output just is a lot less. And the only music that gets released is, you know, the cream of the crop. It's all like, it all just gets fucking released. So to try find stuff that you like within that, like it's almost daunting and you go, nah, too hard. I'll just go back to the stuff that I know I enjoy.
That's also being 40.
Yeah, you also like just can't be bothered.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. I could be bothered, but like it's just the where do you start? Like you go on Spotify or go on, you know, Apple Music. It's like where do you start? And then how do you know that their algorithm is serving you up stuff? Like why does their algorithm specifically know what they're serving up to you is what you want to hear? Like I'm sure there's artists and stuff out there that you would absolutely love. But you'll just never discover them because there's just, you know, a huge, like, never-ending hole of artists and songs and bands that, like, you'll never get to it all.
Yeah, yeah. No, you're right. It's a lot of there was less is more, and now it's the other way around. There's so much music, and it's so easy to get it. It's just sort of hard to find, you know, what you want, you know.
You'd have to Google this and check the stats, but yeah. Someone told me, or somehow this is a random fact that I know, but I think Spotify has something like 30,000 new songs being released every day.
I would not be surprised.
That's an insane amount of songs.
Yeah. Yeah. And did you ever sort of look into when you put the last song out as an example, did you get caught up in looking at the app and seeing the numbers or whatever, or did you just stay away from that?
Yeah, not really. I guess you look at it a little bit, but it's probably more from the point of just engagement, like seeing who you're engaging with and who's the song resonating with, rather than going like, oh, what's the stream number at? I think if you worry too much about what the stream number's at, then, you know, that like I guess you lose sight of why are you doing it?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, some people love the science of it; they find it really interesting.
The data is really interesting. Like you know, to be able to go in and see, you know, what countries people are listening in, and I mean, all that stuff is, you know, that stuff is really fascinating. But yeah, you can't. I mean, the actual just the number of streams. Like I don't know.
Oh, it's nuts.
That's not what I'm thinking about.
Big Day Out, 1995 was your first Big Day Out. What was that like walking around backstage as kids? And you had the You were dubbed Nirvana in pajamas, and you had Courtney Love on the bill. What was that pressure like?
I don't know. I don't think we were feeling any pressure. I wasn't. I remember, like, I mean, you know, you still get a bit nervous before a show, but my recollection was we were just kind of doing our thing. I think we were, like, just blissfully unaware. Like, we kind of, well, I felt like there was something bubbling, right? There was something definitely going on. There was a buzz around the band. But at 14 years old, we were just acting like kids, like being silly. And but when it came to the gig, you know, we were very serious about playing the gig and putting on a good show and being professional. But outside of that, I don't know. I didn't feel like I got caught up in any of the other bullshit. And I remember, I remember Courtney Love sniffing around. It's just like, why? Because we're a three-piece and Dan's got blonde hair. I don't even think Daniel would take him like Kurt Cobain, to be honest.
And a lot of that controversy is manufactured by people on the periphery as well. You know, and Courtney might have been just in that frame of mind to run with it. But often that controversy has just been created by a publicist. The story that she might have rushed the high-ace bus he might have been driving off in. I don't know if that actually happened, but...
I don't remember that.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's definitely been blown out of proportion. I didn't care about it.
Have you kept much from that era? Like, or have you been sort of a hoarder? Or, like, is there a shed somewhere where you've kept a lot of stuff, like even your original drum kits or anything like that? Or have you just lost it all over the years?
I would say I'm an anti-hoarder, to be honest. I'm big on just if you don't need it or use it, just get rid of it. But actually, funnily enough, my mother was a hoarder. So, yeah, I've got a lot of her stuff that she kept over the years, and there was a lot of it.
Yeah.
Or there is a lot of it. But, you know, it's kind of, I don't mind because I've gone through a lot of it, and there's some really cool stuff that I didn't expect for her to hold on to, like some old flyers from Dan and I playing as a two-piece at a talent night in high school, and we called ourselves Short Elvis.
I'd never heard that before. Yeah, wow.
Yeah, so there's some like little cool things like that, which I really like. And like I remember Mum kept a couple of news clippings, the original news clippings from stories where, you know, we couldn't get gigs in Newcastle because we were under 18, and how we were craving to play these live shows, but none of the publicans would basically let us onto the premise. Yeah, so like just little things like that, you know, they're kind of like just cool kind of time capsule.
Yeah.
Thing you can go and reminisce.
Before we go, the podcast is called The Rider. Now, you're not much of a drinker these days. That's fine. But maybe tell me what was in the rider for Silverchair in your last tour. Because you were saying that was the one where you were probably doing more of it.
I'll give you one thing that I reckon that you'll like. So because we didn't have anything overly outrageous on our rider. It definitely changed over the years. But when you're on tour, the rider actually becomes your source of like your daily meals.
Yes.
So you kind of, yeah, so you make it up. So you've got lunch and you might have some, you know, breakfast and lunch, maybe some dinner in there too. So but like, you know, that needs to last. But we never had anything too crazy. But I do remember at one stage when you're on tour, it's all about underwear, right? You know,
yes.
Your underwear.
Yes.
Getting clean underwear, undies and socks. And we noticed that at the truck stops in the US, you could buy packs of like 40 pairs of tube socks really cheap. And so we started buying, like you literally, like I'd buy a pack, you'd put it on the bus. And when you finish, look, it's not very good for the environment, but at the time, you know, it worked. I'd buy like a pack of these tube socks and you'd finish wearing a pair of socks and you just throw them in the bin and you just get a fresh pair.
Yeah.
So rather than doing that, we just started putting the socks on the rider.
That's so smart.
Yeah.
And I've heard bands doing this. I've heard bands about putting in new socks, new underwear, pair of shoes. Dave Gleason told me that he wanted St. George jumpers in his. So every gig he'd do was a St. George jersey.
Dave Gleason. I don't know what Dave Gleason was doing with St. George jumpers on the rider.
Because he's a Newcastle boy. I don't get it either, but that's what he said.
Doesn't make sense to me. But look, look, clothing on a rider, particularly when you're on tour, are like the essentials, undies and socks, brilliant idea. And we definitely did socks at some point.
Really smart. Well, mate, it's so good to catch up, and I appreciate you fitting me in because you are juggling just a couple of things, maybe three things at the moment, and I know it's a lot of responsibility, so congratulations on the family life, mate, and I can't wait to hear more music, which is coming out in the near future as well, so I'll be looking out for that.
Yeah. Cool. Look, thanks for the support, mate. I appreciate it.
Mate, have a good night, mate. I'll see you around.
All right. See you, mate.
Ben Gillies. So good to have him on the rider. Make sure you check out On The Stereo, which is out now. And, of course, catch up on anything you might have missed. It might have been Chit Chat last week, Ray from Thirsty Merc, or even Tim Farris from INXS, all on all those platforms. Next week on the podcast, we go backstage, the Monday Bash, which kicks off next week, just outside of Broken Hill, with Midnight Oil saying goodbye, Jimmy Barnes, and a whole heap more. We'll be backstage at the Monday Bash next weekend. This is The Rider with Becco. We'll catch you then.